And he'd bring them in and he'd do things like knock them off the desk and see if they broke. He'd, you know, pick them up and shake them. He'd turn them upside down and it made sure they kept lighting. I mean, he was like, look, I don't make these myself, but I want to treat them like somebody like me might.
Hi, everyone. I'm Stephanie.
And I'm Jeremy.
Authors of Where Should We Camp Next? A 50-state guide to amazing campgrounds and other unique outdoor accommodations.
Almost 12 years ago, we bought a pop-up camper that changed our lives and introduced us to the joys of RV travel.
Join us now as we talk about where to camp, what gear to bring, and the best food to cook.
We will also keep you dialed in to the latest RV innovations from people in the know.
So pull up a chair and join us around the digital campfire.
This is the RV Atlas. Hello, everybody, and welcome to today's episode of the RV Atlas. Today, I am really excited to be talking about one of my favorite topics when it comes to camping, and that is the Coleman Company, and more specifically, the history of the Coleman Company and its founder, William Coffin Coleman. And my guest today is Terrence Young. Terrence is a professor of geography at California State Polytechnic University, and he's also the author of a really terrific book called Heading Out, A History of American Camping. I read this book 2 years ago and loved every single chapter, really loved every single word, and I learned so much about the history of American camping. And I could do 100 podcasts with Terrence about the different topics in this book, but there was a section in here about the history of Coleman and about the man William Coffin Coleman, who founded the company. And you know, Terrence gets into the history of the founding of the company in a way that I really wanted to get him on the podcast to talk about. So on today's show, we're going to dive into that history and really focus on the origins of the Coleman Company and bring you up to the present moment by the end of the show. So it's a really terrific interview with Terrence. He's a super nice guy. And he's also going to come back really soon, and we're going to do another episode on the birth of American recreational camping in the Adirondacks. So in the weeks ahead, we have two awesome episodes with Terrence, and this is the first one. But before we dive in and talk about the history of the Coleman Company and its role in American history and the history of American camping, we have a sponsored message from our friends at Thetford. Thetford makes going places easy by manufacturing top RV maintenance and sanitation products, and they've been doing it since 1963. Thetford's Aquamax holding treatments neutralize odors and accelerate waste digestion to prevent clumping, clogging, and tank residue, all at the same time. The Aquamax family is Bronopol and formaldehyde-free, so it is campground-friendly and California-compliant. Proudly made in the USA, Thetford's new family of Aquamax holding tank treatments have been extensively researched and tested safe for all RV and marine toilets, holding tanks, and septic systems. Aquamax is available in liquid, toss-in, and dry packets in 7 different sizes and in spring shower scent and summer cypress scent. To find out more, head on over to Thetford.com. The RV Atlas podcast is also sponsored by Campspot. Campspot is an instant booking platform for camping across North America. Research and book the best campgrounds, RV parks, cabins, glamping destinations, and more, whether it's last minute or for your epic road trip months away. And now Campspot is pleased to announce the launch of a mobile app to make it even easier for campers to search, discover, and book their perfect camping trips. With the Campspot mobile app, which is available on both iOS and Android, campers will have access to over 110,000 campsites in 49 states in the U.S. and all 10 Canadian provinces. And because Campspot integrates directly with campground reservation systems, campers can instantly find and book their ideal campspot right in the app. Campspot also offers premium inventory, real-time availability, and a lowest price guarantee so that you can find the best sites at the best campgrounds at the best prices. Plus, you can save your favorite campground finds for future trips and keep all of your reservations organized in one place. Book those summer and fall camping trips now. To find your camp spot, visit campspot.com today. Hello, Terrence Young, and welcome to the RV Atlas. How are you?
I'm very well, Jeremy. It's great to be here.
Terrence, I have wanted to talk to you about your book, Heading Out, for about 2 years now, and I am really incredibly excited to talk to you today about William Kaufman Coleman and the history of the Coleman Company. But before we do that, and I know it's going to be a great conversation, before we do that, this is your first time on the show. Can you tell our audience a little bit about you and what you do?
Sure. I am a professor emeritus of geography at Cal Poly Pomona University, which is in Southern California. I'm a lifelong camper myself. My parents started taking me camping when I was 6 months old, and car camping mostly on the California coast. And I've been camping ever since on my own. And yeah, I'm interested in topics of kind of the out of doors, the use of the out of doors, people's interest in having leisure time activities in places like parks and forests and that sort of thing. So the book was just an outgrowth of that general interest.
And it's a fascinating time in the present moment for your interests. But today we're going to dive back into the past and maybe make some connections to the present as well. I want to talk about William Kaufman Coleman and this amazing Coleman Company. So let's go back to the beginning with him. What can you tell us about his early years before he became this iconic American businessman?
Well, Coleman, who was apparently universally known just simply as W.C. He was born in 1870 in New York State, and he moved to Kansas as an infant. His family had obtained a homestead in Kansas, which is where he grew up. He was a lifelong churchman, was a Baptist, and a big supporter of the YMCA. He held a variety of jobs prior to becoming what we know him for, mostly sales jobs. He was an educator, these sorts of things. And in 1899, he was actually a typewriter salesman when he encountered his first gasoline pressure lamp while he was out on the road in a drugstore. And he was selling typewriters and started to sell the light of lamps, of these lamps that he'd found in Oklahoma in 1900. And you might ask, you know, what do I mean? He sold light. Well, he had no luck trying to sell these lamps. The business people were like, I don't need a lamp. What do I care? So instead, Coleman, being a very clever guy and very sharp businessman, he realized what he should be selling was a service, that is, lighting. So he went into the lighting business in that he rented the lamps for $1 a week, and he told them the deal here is no light, no pay. If the lamp doesn't light your stores and make you happy, you don't have to pay me anything. And so business people were like, well, okay, I can go with that. That's fine. And you might ask, you know, again, well, why would they want light, you know, lights like this? You have to understand that at the time, what electrical lighting was available, and there wasn't a lot. It's the average kind of bulb is about a 15 to 20, what we would say is a 15 to maybe 25 watt bulb. And a 25 watt bulb puts out 250 lumens, right? Just to give you some ground on this. The lamps that Coleman sold these people put out 3,700 lumens. So these were much, much, much brighter. And it made it possible for a business people to stay open in the evenings, you know, so they could, you know, cater to customers who would also be working during the day and could then now come to their stores. So that's pretty much what he was doing when he got into the business of lighting, and which would then lead to lanterns and that sort of thing.
So one of those lights could light up a whole store, I would imagine.
Absolutely.
Right.
Yep.
I mean, I'm thinking of my current Coleman lanterns that I own that are like 750, 800 lumens. That's a bright light right there. So tell us about the hydrocarbon company that WC formed in 1900. And we're going to get closer and closer to the camping part of this.
Sure. So was a company called the Irby Gilliland Company, which was in Memphis. And they were basically what they were crockery wholesalers, right? And they'd made the leap from crockery to containers, lamp containers. You know, these are, you know, tank lights with pressure inside them. So they'd made that leap. Well, Coleman bought the company, just ended up buying the company, and got a good deal on it. And he got all the patents, he got all their stock and stuff, and he renamed it the Hydrocarbon Company, which he felt told people what he was doing, rather than, you know, the Irby Gilliland Company, which, you know, didn't mean anything to most people. And he moved the company from Memphis to Wichita, Kansas.
To which Coleman, to this day, exists as a company, correct?
It is still there. They still have a lot of facilities in Wichita, although they're not technically based there anymore. Their headquarters are now in New York, but they're still there. Yes,
I'm trying to understand the psychology of the man a little bit, and correct me if I'm wrong. But what I'm hearing is he was not so much an inventor by any stretch of the imagination, but just sort of a serial entrepreneur, an opportunist. Does that make sense?
Yes. I think he's someone who recognized what people wanted and what could satisfy that, rather than the kind of technical person. I don't think he ever was that technical at all, like as you say. But he was good at seeing, like, oh, what these business people need is lighting. You know, and he just, you know, it's like asking yourself today, you know, is a big oil company, are they in the petroleum business or are they in the energy business? And I think it's a small but very important distinction. And he was very good at just kind of saying, what do these people want? And then giving them that, you know, finding a way to satisfy.
And why the move to Kansas? Was there a very particular reason why he did that?
Well, I think at a personal level, he was from Kansas, and at the time he was, when he first came across these lamps, he was working in Oklahoma. So I think there was that. But more importantly, Wichita was a much bigger city than Kingfisher, Oklahoma, which is where he was working out of. And so there were a lot more customers potentially in Wichita. And Wichita was, even by 1900, it was known as a distribution center for a lot of the area around it, and for hundreds of miles in the directions around it. It had good rail connections and stuff like that. So one other thing, too, or a couple of other things about Wichita, was that it had a private electric company, local private electric company, but they were unreliable. Sometimes the power would just go out, or there'd be a lot of people using the electricity at night, and it would overload the system. And that would irk the customers who actually were dependent on the lighting, especially businessmen. And the electric system was relatively small in terms of the city of Wichita. And lighting, Coleman used to say, the more people embrace the idea of electrical lighting and electrical conveniences, the better it is for my company. Because the electrical system and the electrical lighting was relatively limited in area and limited in brightness, as we were talking about, and limited in reliability. So he would just come in and say, I know you want the light from those electric systems, but at the moment, how about my gas pressure light instead? You know, so there was a lot of demand for reliable lighting. And in a month after he moved to Wichita, he had 300 clients. And soon after, he extended his service to a lot more of Oklahoma than he had been, to San Diego, California, to Las Vegas in Nevada, and to Albuquerque in New Mexico. And by 1909, he was, and his company was, producing its first table lamp. Up until this time, all the lamps had been hanging lamps from the ceilings, or hanging them outside on a rafter or something like that. And now he switched to table lamps. And in 1912, he changed the company's name to the Coleman Lamp Company. And then he launched Coleman Lanterns 2 years after that in 1914.
Now, what amazes me, and I would argue that Coleman is the most iconic American camping company in our history. And what I find kind of astonishing is he did not intentionally try to get into the camping business, correct?
Oh, no. No, this is not where he started. It was never in the foreground at first. No, what happened was the lanterns, which they started producing in 1914, the lanterns were intended for farmers. That was their biggest customer base that they saw, because most farms were isolated and were being on electrical grid. He was interested in the jobs that would have to take place in the field, like things like a train derailment or some other sort of natural disaster, or fixing roads out at night, anything that had to be done at night. You know, this is who they thought of as their customers. But hunters, fishers, and campers quickly embraced the lanterns because they saw it as the same sort of thing. And in 1917, the company, now recognizing that camping could be, you know, a market for them, they ran their first ad, and they did so also to coincide with the introduction of what they called the quick light lantern.
And those quick lights sold really, really well, did they not?
Oh, yes, extremely well. I'm trying to see here. What do we go? In 1918, the sales of those quick light lanterns outsold the combined sales of all other Coleman lanterns. So they come out in 17, and by 1918, those are outselling all the other lanterns that the company is making of any kind. And by 1922, just 5 years later, the company is selling over 91,000 the quick light lanterns in 1 year, which is an immense amount of product.
Oh, and considering the population of the country at that time, I mean that's probably a good enough number today to run a vibrant business. Can you explain, at least in a very basic sense, to our audience that might not be familiar with these types of lanterns, how they operate, just at a very novice level?
Sure. Yeah, they're technically very interesting, but I'm not going to go there because I'm not an engineer either. They're called gasoline pressure lamps or lanterns, and it's like the stoves. Basically, you put kerosene or white gasoline inside the tank on one of these lanterns. You pump it up. Then open the valve, and the valve, what it does is it mixes both gas and air together, so it turns into a gas-air mixture as it comes up, and then it goes into the little bags, right, that are on the lanterns called mantles, and those mantles are not just – they're basically cotton, so they're very light and simple, but they're impregnated with something called thorium. And thorium, if you heat it up with this gas-air mixture, glows really, really bright. So these lanterns, again, can go as high as 2,500 lumens. So again, you're talking about lanterns that can be very bright.
And they give off some warmth, which is nice. And they make that wonderful hissing sound, which is brings back a lot of memories of childhood for a lot of people that have been camping for a long time, right?
Yes. Yeah. Now that you say that, of course. Yeah. Yeah. That's a sound I grew up with. That kind of steady hissing.
And do you still use one of these types of Coleman lanterns when you camp?
Yes, I do. I'm lucky that way. My parents bought a Coleman lantern about 1948. I'm not absolutely sure. It was before I was born. It's a Model 220. The only things I've had to replace or fix is the filler cap, the pump leather, which is a little thing down inside the pump handle. I didn't even know it was in there until it broke, and the generator. But everything else on it, and I've had to replace the mantles, of course, go along. But everything else on it is original, and it works spotlessly. It starts every time. Always very bright, very reliable. Here, you know, whatever.
It's kind of miraculous. Terrence, it's kind of miraculous in a sense that I don't know if you know this about me. I have 17 of these lanterns. I started collecting them for a while, and I'm not super handy with them necessarily, but they do. They just keep working and working and working. And then even someone like me who's not super handy, if one of them stops working, I can usually find a YouTube video and some simple instructions. Yep. And fix it myself. So I find them to just be incredibly, incredibly durable and well made.
They absolutely. Well, and this is where WC comes back, sort of back into the picture, in that his name was on the company, right? And his name's on the product. And like a lot of entrepreneurs who have their name on their company, they don't want anything with their name to be shabby or unreliable or, you know, poor quality or whatever. And WC was, I mean, there's many stories about him that they'd say, okay, we're going to do a new version of this or that lamp or lantern or something. And he'd bring them in and he'd do things like knock them off the desk and see if they broke. He'd, you know, pick them up and shake them. He'd turn them upside down. And it made sure they kept lighting. I mean, he was like, look, I don't make these myself, but I want to treat them like somebody like me might. And they have to pass that test.
What a great test to have to pass. I'm sorry. Go ahead. Finish your thought.
Oh, no. Just, you know, I think it's, you know, that, like you say, here we are 75 years later. I have a 75-year-old, basically, lantern. Works fine, and I've been able to fix it. And like you, I'm not particularly mechanical, but I have contacted the company and said, hey, my pump doesn't work anymore. And they sent me the pump leather. They just sent it to me and said, here, you just go inside, gave me a little diagram and said, here's what you do. And I'm like, wow, you know, how many companies would still be doing that to anything from 75 years ago?
Terrence, I sent a 1961 Coleman 200A lantern back to Coleman in Kansas, back to the company. I paid $50 or something, and because it wasn't working, and they fixed it and sent it back to me with a handwritten letter from a man named Roger who worked in the service department at Coleman. And it just felt like a blast from the past. I was incredibly impressed, and at the same time almost saddened, because I wonder how much longer that type of service department will stay open for a company like Coleman. But we're going to come back in a second, and we're going to talk more about Coleman and about Coleman stoves. But before we do that, we have a sponsored message from our friends at Jayco. The brand new Jayco Swift Class B is an exciting addition to Jayco's motorhome lineup. Built on the Ram ProMaster chassis, the Swift lineup is packed with modern technology and industry-leading comfort features that make this agile and versatile Class B a perfect choice for day trips, weekend getaways, or epic adventures across the country. The standard 190-watt roof-mounted GoPower solar panel, along with the standard 1,000-watt inverter, also make the Swift ready for camping off-grid. Thule roof and bike racks also let you bring your favorite gear along for the adventure. The Jayco Swift 20T is a perfect couples coach that features comfortable twin beds, lots of overhead storage, and a spacious rear bath and wardrobe. The Jayco Swift 20A has seatbelt positions for four people and is perfect for families that need a base camp for sports tournaments or winter days at the slopes and summer days at the beach. To find out more about the Jayco Swift Class B, head on over to jayco.com. All right, welcome back to the show, Terrence. Let's talk about the iconic Coleman stove now, because it wasn't just all about the lanterns. So how did Coleman get into making gasoline pressure stoves, and were they a great success like the lanterns?
They had been making stoves for a number of years, but domestic stoves. They made them for inside the house. Most people probably don't know. They were one of the biggest manufacturers of indoor heating systems and stoves for many years, decades in America. But in the early 20th century, it's a business they got out of a long time ago. But they hadn't really plan to get into the, you know, portable stove business, but they decided to finally do that in 1923 because a couple of other companies who also made domestic stoves and ovens and things like that, especially the American Gas Machine Company, they had started doing this in as early as 1912, and Coleman realized, it's a business. We, you know, let's get into this. People are asking. We can do this. So they just adapted their domestic stove technology, made it portable. And again, it right off the bat, their Coleman stoves were very popular. As I said, they introduced it in 1923. They sold over 33,000 stoves in 1924. And by 1928, they were selling over 50,000 a year. So again, I think just it immense, it took right off. But they were again made with the quality and the thinking that had gone into the lanterns.
And the popularity of auto camping at that time was pretty immense, right? I mean, that was a kind of a zeitgeist moment for American auto camping, correct? And that's tied into the success of these stoves and lanterns.
Yes. Yeah. Auto camping had really begun after the First World War ended in 1918. Before that, cars were just too expensive, and there were too few of them. But after the First World War, cars became cheaper. They became lots of used ones. Their credit went down, and the cars got bigger. And that's really important because as they got larger, they could carry more people and more equipment, more gear. And stoves, Coleman stoves, Coleman lanterns, were able to, you know, people could now put them onto their automobiles. Anyway, car camping, auto camping after or during the 1920s just boomed. I would say, actually, from my own perspective, that the real heyday of car camping, in a sense of how much it was culturally significant, was the 1920s. There were more people physically camping after World War II in the United States, but as a percent of the population, the 1920s are the real high point. It was something everyone did.
Now, Coleman strikes me as a marketing genius to some degree, too, or at least someone who was really, really good and perhaps even ahead of the times with his marketing and what we would often call content marketing now. So tell us a little bit about the Coleman Motor Camper's Manual.
So Coleman hired – the company hired Frank Brimmer. Brimmer was a very well-known radio personality out of Chicago and a writer, and he was somebody who talked a great deal about on his shows and in his writing that he talked a lot about camping, and he'd written books about camping and stuff like this. He'd wrote a book called Roughing It Smoothly about car camping, and so he was one of the best-known people in the United States in terms of camping. So Coleman hired him, and they asked him to write a motor, what they called the Coleman Motor Camper, Motor Camper Manual. And in it, it was a lot of how-to advice and what to do, but it was also an enormous advertisement for the company. You know, like, okay, you're going to need to go camping and you need a stove. Well, how about these kind, you know, and they would be Coleman, and here's how you do it, and here's how you camp. Because we should never assume people starting out camping have any real idea how to do it. And Brimmer being so well known, he was just I don't know who else they could have hired that would have done a better job and would have been more impactful than Brimmer.
So you're teaching people about camping, about the lifestyle, giving them tips and tricks, and then there's the product right there mentioned in some way or in an illustration or something like that. I actually have a little Coleman book from the 1960s that's actually packed with great articles. There's probably 12 great articles in it, and then there's just Coleman ads on every single page. So this is great advertising at this time. It's terrific.
Oh, yeah. I mean, the company was, they were, aggressive advertisers. You know, they recognized, you know, that they needed to keep telling their potential customers that we're here, you can use us, we can do this, you know, we're very supportive. I mean, they advertised, they spent a lot of time, money, and labor on advertising. They advertised in Saturday Evening Post, they advertised in Country Gentleman, they advertised in Outdoor America, they advertised in Field and Stream, and lots of other magazines. They also advertised in lots of newspapers around the country, both major and local newspapers. They produced a lot of point-of-sale items, and their salesmen, as they went around, would just give these away to you know, sporting goods stores, hardware stores, places like that. And in the 19 – oh, go ahead.
No, you go ahead. No, you go ahead.
Oh, I was just going to say, even in the 1920s, they sent out a vehicle to both repair – Coleman equipment to drive around, you know, it'd be like, okay, don't miss it. You know, this coming Thursday, the Coleman repairman is coming to town, but he also was a, you know, a promotional vehicle for, Coleman products. So yeah, they were very creative.
You know, I can't help but think, you know, from my own experience working in this space, that money that they were funneling into print advertising and even these books, that kind of advertising money now is spent on social media marketing and Instagram and working with influencers. And it's so different, but so the same, you know, all at the same time. Now, this was also like a zeitgeist moment back then in the 20s for the great outdoors in a way that at least has some, you know, echoes with what's happening today. So many people want to get outside because of the pandemic, because it was safer, because people don't want to be cooped up in their homes. Was there anything similar going on then? What was driving people to get into the great outdoors besides cars becoming cheaper and bigger? Was there anything else?
Well, I mean, if we go back to the beginning of camping in the United States, I think you can see it as a sort of response to Americans increasingly living in cities. American culture long has this idea of nature is really good and special, and cities are, you know, suspect at best. And campers have talked about that since the very beginning. Let's get out of town, you know, and it's not – why I titled my book Heading Out is it's not so much about going to nature as it is getting out of cities.
So, Terrence, the Coleman Company continued to have explosive growth in the decades ahead. I mean, we've been talking a lot about the 1920s, but Coleman was huge in the 30s and the 40s and the 50s and the 60s. In the 70s, I mean, is it fair to say that the company just grew and grew and grew and got bigger and bigger and bigger for the next almost 50 years?
Yes, that's pretty much it. The company, the only year the Coleman Company ever lost money was 1930. And that was a very small amount. Every year during the Great Depression, they made money. They got bigger. They expanded their product lines. They made more versions of things. Yes, and as you say, they're iconic. I would put them in the same category as Airstream trailers, maybe, or Winnebago, you know, motorhomes, or I don't know, Kelty Packs, something like this. Their name is, I think, you'd be hard pressed to find a camper who has never heard of Coleman.
So what? How did the company fall out of family hands? I mean, when did WC die? It's now owned by a larger corporation. So can you give us a little bit of that, you know, that transition out of WC's hands?
Well, sadly, the company in 1989, the Coleman family owned about 25% of the company, and they wanted to own it all. They wanted to take the company private. It had been in the stock market and stuff. They decided to hold an auction, which is risky, and they lost. They offered $68 a share, and a corporate raider basically offered $74 and won. And so after 89 years, the Coleman family no longer had anything to do with the company. And sadly, the corporate raider sold off a big chunk of the company to pay for the bid to buy it. something the Colemans never would have done, and then sold the remaining amount to the company to make a profit to a number of other companies. And now it's owned by Newell Brands, is the current owner of the company.
Now, I don't want to, you know, lapse into sort of cliches, but, you know, you're talking about a company that for 80 plus years made high quality camping equipment that you could truly pass on from generation to generation. I mean, it is not me being sappy saying that, you know, fathers would pass on their Coleman lanterns to their sons. You know, has the company lost its luster? Are they still making these types of products? Is it just a totally unrecognizable company at this point?
No, I mean, they continue to make gasoline pressure lanterns and stoves and new ones. So I can't, and I haven't been to a Coleman store or whatever to see whether or not they're still made of exactly the same quality, but they're still making those. And as you pointed out, they're still offering good service, but they've become less a company that's pushing the boundaries and the envelope on product lines. And more just a company that also carries, you know, you want a particular kind of ice chest, we have those too. You want a different kind of tent, sure, we've got those. It's now become a much more diversified kind of, I would call it more a line of camping materials rather than a company associated with a couple of particular and very well-known products.
And I think a lot of those the gas-powered products are kind of falling off the marketplace a little bit too. You know, you don't go into a Cabela's or Bass Pro Shop and necessarily see those Coleman products anymore, though they do seem to still offer them in very rare places.
They do, but, you know, people have taken a lot more to natural gas sort of approaches with pressurized or pre-pressurized and stuff rather than, you know, using the old gas pressure stoves that you had to pump up yourself.
So any final thoughts on WC and this great company that he created? I mean, anything else that you want to share with our audience about WC before we wrap it up here?
Well, I think he was a great businessman. He was beloved by the company, by the employees. The only year that company, when he ran it, lost any money was 1930, which is pretty impressive, having gone, consider how many companies went bankrupt in the Great Depression. And he loved the company all the way to the end, and he died in 1957 at the age of 87. And I have to think his son took it over. I have to think he was pretty happy with where everything was.
Terrence, thank you so much for coming on the show. And I'm also pleased to let everybody know you're going to come back again in the very near future. We're going to talk about sort of the birth of American recreational camping in the Adirondacks. So I'm really looking forward to that. And I thank you so much for your time today.
Oh, it's my pleasure, Jeremy. And I look forward to talking to you soon.
Yeah. And the book is Heading Out, A History of American Camping. And I could do 100 podcasts talking to you about this book. It was wonderful. I absolutely loved reading it. And anyone listening, I'm sure you could head on out to Amazon or order it at your local bookstore. So, Terrence, look forward to talking to you again soon.
A big thank you for listening to this episode of the RV Atlas. And a big thanks to our sponsors.
To Jayco, the Thetford Corporation, CampSpot, Yogi Bear's Jellystone Park Camp Resorts, and our friends at Ocala Marion County in Florida.
To find out more about the topics discussed in this show, visit thervatlas.com.
And join the friendliest group of RVers over at the RV Atlas Group on Facebook.
And if you enjoyed this show, please consider leaving us a review over at iTunes.
And we'll see you at the campground.
See you at the campground.